All right, good morning, everyone. Let's begin. So what I wanted to focus on this morning a little bit is instead of our regular Tehillim share, and again, I should really begin by apologizing for the cancellation last week. I'm sorry, just unforeseen time. Unforeseen circumstances, but in Mirat Hashem, I believe this is our last shiur. This is our last shiur before Pesach. So I want to just take a little break from Tehillim, just for this 1 week, and in Mirat Hashem, focus on an interesting theme of the Seder. Focus on an interesting theme of the Seder, and in Mirat Hashem, after Pesach, I don't know, is that a new semester? Or that's a continuation? Okay, so in our next semester, Mirat Hashem, we'll continue from Kapitel Tazayin once more. Let's take a look at number one. So the Gemara Maseches Pesachim says the following. The Gemara says, actually it's a Mishnah, Mazgulo Kos Sheni, we pour the second cup, the second of the four cups, the Kan HaBen Shoel Ovid. And here the child begins to ask the questions. V'im Ein Das B'Ben, Ovid Malamdo, and if a child doesn't ask on their own, the parent prods the child, prompts the child, Man Mishtana HaLayla Zemikol HaLeilos. Okay? But that's what I'm going to focus on. I want to draw your attention to the second line. The Gemara now, the Mishnah goes ahead and gives us the paradigm or the framework for the Pesach Seder. What's the framework? Maschil Beginus Umisayim B'Shevach. How is the Seder structured? We begin Ginus. Ginus means what? Shame, degradation, negative. We begin with the negative. We begin with the... Ginus actually is a very strong word. Ginus actually really means shame. A genai means something shameful. So maschil beginus literally means we begin with the shameful aspects, umisayim b'shevach, but we conclude with praise. And this becomes, says the Mishnah, the model or the framework for the Pesach Seder. So the Gemara number 2 says, well, what does that mean? Meaning, how exactly does that translate into the Pesach Seder? So the Gemara says, maschil beginus umisayim b'shevach, my beginus. What does that mean? First of all, shame of what? Shame of who? What are we referring to? Rav Amar, Mitchila Ovdei Avodas Gilulim Hayu Avosenu, Ushmuel Amar Avadim Hayinu. So the Gemara now here says the following, that the Ginus, the shameful aspects, refers to the people, refers to us, that we begin with the shameful aspects of the people, and Misayim B'Shevach, we end with praise, whether that's praise of the fact that now we're free, praise of our newfound standing, praise of God. But the Gemara says, what's the shame that we begin with? Well, Rav says, we refer to the fact that originally, we were idolaters. We hail from idolaters. And Shmuel says, no, the Gnus, the shame, is that we begin by acknowledging the fact that we were slaves, that we were not free men. From a human being perspective, the most shameful thing that one could admit to is that one is not autonomous. Right? As human beings, we strive for constant autonomy. So Avadim Hayinu, we admit the fact that we were not always autonomous, we were not always free, we began as slaves. So before we get in analyzing this particular framework, so let's just take one step back. So now what the Gemara is telling us, what the Mishnah and the Gemara are telling us, is that the Pesach Seder follows a theme. Now, it's of course very interesting because sometimes when you look at the Haggadah doesn't always flow naturally. Meaning, it flows for us because often we're just used to doing it so many years. But the truth is, if you look at it piece after piece after piece, it actually does not flow well. Meaning, if you try to submit the Haggadah as an essay, you know, in your English or in your Hebrew literature class, you'd get an F because the paragraphs don't connect with each other. Thematically, there often does not seem to be an underlying common denominator. Now, there is. You just, like most things in Judaism, you have to actually work. You have to roll up your sleeves to be able to appreciate it. But leaving aside how one paragraph goes into the next, the Mishnah is telling us there is a theme. And the theme is a thematic progression. We begin with Ginus. We begin with the shameful, degrading aspects of our national beginnings, but we end b'shevach. We end with an incredible praise of the people, of us, and ultimately of God. What's the ginus? What's the shame? That's a dispute. Rav says, We highlight the fact that we were originally idolaters. We hail from idolaters. And Shmuel says that we go ahead and we relate the fact that we are originally servants. Now, before we analyze the framework, what are Rav and Shmuel actually arguing about? Let me explain that question for just a moment. In general, when it comes to analyzing Judaic texts, so if you look at a piece of Gemara, or you look at any Judaic text, and you see two people arguing, so what's the first question you have to ask yourself? What is at the root of the argument? Right? We know that in life, when people argue, sometimes the arguments are not about what people say they're about, but it's about something deeper. So you could say, yes, Rav is saying we should begin talking about the negative idolatrous roots. Shmuel says we should begin talking about the negative servitude roots. But what is what we call the Nekudas HaMachlokes? What is the actual point of contention? So if we take a look at number four, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, in his commentary, beautiful essays on the Haggadah. And just before we go on, we should have in mind that all of our learning today, unfortunately, there are five major levayas happening in Eretz Yisrael, happened in Eretz Yisrael already this morning. The levaya of Rav Scheinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and the levayos of the four shooting victims in the massacre in Toulouse. And we should just hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, all of these precious neshama should have an aliyah. So Rabbi Lau, in number four, says the following. Rabbi Lau writes, Ma'u ha-ginus v'ha-shevach. What is it? What are they arguing about? What are Rav and Shmuel act? What's their point of contention? Nechleku b'kach Rav and Shmuel b'gemara. L'das Rav, Yishlomar mitchila ov de avodah zara hayu avosein. Skip down to the second paragraph. Kilomar, Rav sover, sheyesh lahadgish es hatzad hatorani. Shemetchila hayu avosein ov de avodah zara. Ukineged ze kirvanu hamakom lavodoso. Ve'ilu Shmuel sover, sheyesh lahadgish es hatzad haenoshi. Shemetchila hayinu avodin lemitzrayim. Ukineged ze yatzana lecherus. So Rabbi Lau makes an incredible suggestion. Rabbi Lau wants to suggest that Rav and Shmuel are really arguing on what aspect of freedom are we highlighting on Pesach? Are we highlighting physical freedom? Or are we highlighting theological or spiritual freedom? What is the emphasis of Pesach? So Rav and Shmuel each have their own opinion. So Rav says, what's the emphasis of Pesach? Spiritual freedom. And therefore we begin by speaking about what? Spiritual or theological servitude. Therefore, according to Rav, what's the first thing we should highlight on Pesach? According to Rav, that we were idolaters. That we hail from idolaters. Now, by the way, you know who is that referring to when we hail from idolaters? Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was an idolater. Avram Avinu was a prominent idolater. Avram Avinu was one of the most important idolaters. The Rambam writes, then he found the Kadosh Baruch Hu, he found God, but Avram Avinu was an idolater. So ultimately, says Rav, the essence of Pesach is a celebration of spiritual freedom. We spiritually progressed, and therefore the ginus, the shame, the degradation that we begin with, is mitchila ov de avodah zara hayu avosenu. We were idolaters, but look how far we have come. As opposed to Shmuel, who holds that the emphasis of Pesach is what? Is what? Physical freedom. And therefore, the ginus refers to, the shamefulness refers to what? Physical servitude. Avodim hayinu leparo b'mitzrayim. That we were servants to Pharaoh in Egypt. And in fact, if you look at number 5, Rav Soloveitchik highlights this same idea. This is actually from a Haggadah titled An Exalted Evening, written by Rabbi Menachem Ginnack, who was a Talmud Mufak of Rav Soloveitchik. He recorded, as you know, the Rav actually wrote very little. You know, it's an interesting thing. Every year there's a new book of the writings of the Rav that comes out, which is quite amazing. You know, there are very few people that could do that from beyond. But the Rav really committed very little to writing. That has a lot to do with the fact that the Rav in general, not a shir on the Rav, but it's interesting to point out that the Rav was very scarred from his dealings with the Jewish community. When the Rav was in Boston, which happens, right? When the Rav was in Boston, so the Rav took a very hard line against what was happening with the Shochtim. The Rav wanted to go ahead and there were Shochtim who were who were not being totally scrupulous in some of their dealings in terms of the realm of ritual slaughter, and he took a very hard line. He was the Rav there at the time. He wanted to really stabilize, but he wanted to create an appropriate halachic framework for Shechita, and they actually ganged up against the Rav, and the Rav was turned into the IRS for tax fraud. The amazing resolution of that is it turned out that after incredible investigation, Rav Soloveitchik had overpaid on repeated years for his taxes. It created a terrible, terrible chilul Hashem. Actually, the circuit judge, rebuked some of the members of the Boston community for having treated Rav Soloveitchik that way. But that event left a very negative impression on the Rav, and to a certain degree, you see after that event that he retreated much from communal life and really became a Rosh Yeshiva. He really was a Rosh Yeshiva. That's why, again, you know, one of the most difficult things is so many Talmidei HaRav, so many of the students of Rav Soloveitchik have, you know, this one says the Rav said this, or this one says the Rav said that, which often happens with great people, but also because the Rav was so reticent to put things in writing and was so reticent to come out just with proclamations, leads to a lot of confusion sometimes among his Piskei Halacha as well. So Rabbi Ganak, one of the Talmidim of the Rav, put together Rav Soloveitchik's idea on Haggadah. The Rav never wrote a commentary on the Haggadah, but certainly he espoused many ideas about Pesach, about the Haggadah, and Rabbi Ganak organized them. And this is in English, an exalted evening. It's a wonderful, wonderful Haggadah. So Rav Soloveitchik in number 5 highlights pretty much the same idea that Rabbi Lau did. Rabbi Lau highlights some ideas of Soloveitchik. So number 5, the Rav writes, the dispute between Rav and Shmuel might be understood as follows. There are two aspects of slavery, the physical and the spiritual. In approaching the shameful aspects of slavery, Rav emphasizes the spiritual degradation of the enslaved Jews. Shmuel, however, emphasizes the physical degradation of the Jews that resulted from bondage. Thus, Rav and Shmuel are each focusing on one of the two dimensions of slavery. So this is how to understand their dispute, which, by the way, is very important just for framing the Pesach Seder in the right way. What is it that we are celebrating? Are we celebrating spiritual liberation? Are we celebrating the fact that we were once non-believers, that we were once polytheists, that we were once idolaters, and now we have become monotheists? Or are we actually focusing and celebrating on the fact that we were physically liberated from this, from the bonds of Egypt? Now, just interestingly enough, if you go back to the first page, well, if you look at number 3, so if you look back, the truth is, it doesn't have to be an either-or. In fact, if you look at the Haggadah, we actually accept both of the positions of Rav and Shmuel. So how do we begin the Haggadah? Number 3, Avadim hayinu leparo b'mitzrayim. So we begin by discussing that we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, i.e. we begin with the degradation of human servitude. But in the very next paragraph, what do we say? Mitchila ovde avodazara hayu avosenu. Immediately in the next paragraph, we make reference to the fact that we were idolaters. So in reality, we don't have to make a choice. We accept that the Gnus, we highlight the shamefulness of both human servitude, as well as theological servitude, the fact that we were idolaters, and we highlight both of these on the Pesach Seder. Yes?
So you told me in one of your shirim that slaves have no time. So if you're not physically liberated, there's no way you're going to have a spiritual life.
It's 100% true as well, right? It's a very good point that in reality, they're very much linked. That individuals who have very little physical autonomy have difficulty having spiritual autonomy as well. Although, you'll come to tonight's Shir Tanya and you'll see it's not so clear. It's not so clear. We might be able to make another argument against that as well. Yes? Oh, that's way back. 100%. Well, I'm saying at the end of the day, it's interesting to note that we accept both opinions, meaning we highlight the genus of servitude in Egypt, and you're right, the fact that we were idolaters way before Egypt. Way before Egypt. So that they don't have to be mutually exclusive. Does that answer you? So I'm just saying, Rav and Shmuel clearly are disagreeing, meaning according to Rav, the Seder looks one way, according to Shmuel, the Seder looks a different way. But for our purposes, the fact that we adopt both of their approaches, because again, at the Leil HaSeder, we dwell on the fact that we were originally theologically enslaved, that we were idolaters, and we also which preceded the Egyptian experience, and we also highlight the fact that we were physically enslaved in Egypt. Yes? I think there are conflicting accounts of it. We know that they definitely took, Avodah Zarah was taken out of Egypt with them. Right? The Medrash highlights that Pesel Micha came with them into Yam Suf. So they had idols with them. The Torah doesn't record them as having worshipped idolatry. They seem to have been totally separate and distinct from Egyptian culture. If anything, it would appear that the major theological issue for the Jews in Egypt was not idolatry, it was apathy. It was apathy. They weren't connecting with any higher being. But the fact that you have the Medrash saying that they took Avodah Zarah out with them would seem to indicate that it was there. That it was there. Okay, but now what I'd like to that's just the Machlokes Rav and Shmuel. So now we understand what they're really arguing about. We also realize that the truth is it's not such a major dispute because it's one of those disputes where we could adopt both of the opinions as being correct as we do as part of the Pesach Seder. But let's spend a couple of moments analyzing the framework. Meaning, if there's one thing the Gemara seems to say is that we have to begin with Genus and end with Shevach. We have to go through this process of beginning with shame, the shame of physical enslavement, the shame of theological enslavement, and only then can we work our way to the praise of liberation, ultimately the praise of ourselves and the praise of God. The question is, why? Why can't we just skip all the shame and just simply get to the praise? Meaning, especially, if you remember, the entire essence of the Pesach Seder is what? What are we supposed to accomplish over the course of the Pesach Seder? Good. Good. We have to feel free. That's the goal of the Pesach Seder. You have to feel free. Everything else is true. But at the end of the day, a person has to somehow emerge from the Pesach Seder with a renewed sense of freedom. I'm going to cover that tonight in my 8 o'clock shir at the shul. So you can hear that online also. We're not going to talk about that today, about what that actually means. But the idea is that's the goal of the Seder. That's the goal of the Seder, to feel free. Chai of Adam Liros is Atzmo, Ki'ilu Hu Yatsa Mimitraim. I have this obligation to feel free. So it's interesting to note that if the obligation of the night is to feel free, yet we begin with this Ginus. We have to begin with the shame. We have to begin with the shame of, again, physical servitude, theological servitude, and the question becomes, why? So there are a couple of different approaches to coming to appreciate this framework. So take a look at number 8. I'm going to skip a little bit. Take a look at number 8. I put more on the sheet than what we're going to cover here. Yeah, they're always online. Yes. I'm sorry. It's suburbanorthodox.org. And on the right hand menu is all of the. It says I don't know if it says shiurim or classes, but it says something there. And the day will come when we'll stop giving live shiurim altogether. Right? We'll just put it online. But it's all there. So take a look at number 8. So the Marashah says the following. The Marashah says something very interesting. Because again, so you understand our fundamental question, which is, now, why go ahead and create this framework? Why can't we skip the Ginus, skip all the shame, go right to the Shevach? So the Marashah says something very interesting. He says, in Yono, number 8, Maschil B'Ginus U'Mesayim, in Yono, Shebiyom Simchas Libo Shel Adam, that on a day when a person is very happy, very glad, Yiskor Tchilas Shifluso Uginuso. A person should always remember what? Shifluso Uginuso. What does that mean? Loneliness and degradation. Shelotazuach Dato Alov. In order that a person not get carried away. Now, what does this mean? So we know from a Hashkafic perspective, there's always been an ongoing dispute between the schools of thought of Shifluso Shel Adam, Gadluso Shel Adam. What should a person be focusing on? Should a person be focusing on their nothingness? Or should a person be focusing on their somethingness? So, you know, for example, in pre-war Europe, so one of the major yeshivas, it was Nirvaduk. So Nirvaduk's approach was Shifluso Shel Adam. Man is nothing. Man is nothing. Don't think you're something because you're nothing. And even if you still do something, you're still nothing. Because ultimately, man, as the Mishnah in Avos says, man comes from a tipa sucha, comes from a putrid drop, and ultimately man goes back into the earth and simply becomes dust. So what is man? Other school of thought says, no, man is great. Man is only one little bit, one small stage below HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're B'Tzelem Elokim. So by definition, we're great. By definition, we're holy. Do we have faults? Do we have lackings? Of course. But we're still, each and every one of us, is something beautiful and magnificent. So who's right? See, interestingly enough, history has seemed to have proven that the Nirvaduk movement is not a sustainable movement. You can't tell people they're nothing. You can't tell people they're nothing because nobody wants to go through life feeling like a nothing, right? And by the way, it's not just from a theological perspective. If people think that they're nothing, that ultimately translates into self-esteem problems in many areas in life. So history has seemed to show, meaning if you look at the movements that have rebuilt themselves from the ashes of the Holocaust, right? Because we had to the world of Torah had to be reconstructed after the Churban of the Holocaust. So the Nirvaduk movement, although it still does exist, is really a very small slice of the Jewish spectrum. It appears, and especially I think in our day and age, you can't sell Judaism by telling people that they're nothing, right? Because the truth is, we live in an age of self-affirmation, which is a good thing. We live in an age of positive self-esteem. So to tell people that they're nothing is a little bit of a difficult sell. But yet, we know that as much as we're something, that somethingness, that self-awareness, must always be peppered with a little bit of, what's the right word?
Humility.
Humility. Good. A humility, meaning I'm a something, but I've also got a lot more. We see this, by the way, this is one of the major flaws in New Age parenting. Right? So New Age parenting often puts the child on the same level as the adults. Right? I'm not going to punish you. Tell me how you're feeling. Right? Use your words. Right? Sometimes the child's supposed to get a patch. Sometimes the child's supposed to go to their room. And sometimes it's not about reasoning with them. It's about laying down the law and telling them that I'm the parent, you're the child, and you have to listen. And the problem is that children who grow up being put on the same pedestal as parents really grow up with a horribly inflated ego, thinking that they actually have a say in everything, that they actually know everything. It's exceptionally, they're seeing this, meaning psychologists are seeing this now come up to be the incredible negative byproducts of all of these New Age positive parenting techniques. That's not our topic, but what the Marsha is saying is that life is a balance. That on one hand, you have to go ahead and feel that you're an incredible something, but how do you feel like a something without developing an inflated ego? How do you feel like a something without becoming egocentric? So the beautiful part about Judaism is that every single thing in Judaism that it's supposed to make us feel like a something always has a built-in mechanism to keep the ego in check. So says the Marsha, what are we supposed to do at the Leil HaSeder? We're supposed to be royalty. We're supposed to see royalty. You know, there are a lot of interesting things that happen at the Leil HaSeder that don't happen anywhere else. The Shulchan Aruch rules that a person should never put out all of their fine china and all of their fine crystal. You should never put all of it out. You're always supposed to leave a little something off the table. Why? Why? Zecher l'churban. To remember the destruction of the temple and to realize that until the third Beis HaMikdash is here, our lives are not complete. There's one exception to that, and that is the Leil HaSeder. On the night of the Seder, you're supposed to bring every... Which, of course, is interesting because the Leila Seder is often the time when people have their china closet, you know, closed off, everything. Right? But the idea is, the Leila HaSeder, you're supposed to bring out all of the beautiful items. All the beautiful items. Why? Because I'm royalty. But yet, that feeling of royalty has to somehow be checked. Because it's very easy to go from feeling like royalty to ultimately creating an egocentric experience. So says the Maharsha, how do we do that? Second line, number 8. Umehai taima doresh nami me'arami oved avi va'al kein boi le'aduye u'leshabuche tfei. So what do we do at the Leila Seder? So on the night that we're going to feel like it's something that we're going to feel like royalty, we begin by talking about the not-so-pretty chapters of our national beginnings. So whether it's that we began as slaves, or we began as idolaters, what does it do for us? It humbles us. And by the way, just so you should know, this is an ongoing theme. Where does Malchus Beis David come from? Where does the Davidic line emanate from? Yehuda and Tamar. Right? An episode that the truth is leaves us a little bit uncomfortable, leaves us with a lot of questions. We don't really get too into it because we believe that Yehuda was a tzaddik and whatever his machshavas were. But at the end of the day, Yehuda impregnated a woman who he thought was a prostitute. So you ever wonder to yourself, like, why exactly does the Davidic line, does the Messianic king hail from a story that we would all be exceptionally reticent to teach our own children? You ever wonder about that? Like, you would think a king, Melech HaMashiach, and the answer is, the Maharal says, it keeps the king humble. Because when the king knows that everyone could open up a chumash and read a story that makes us blush just a little bit, you know what? It's an amazing thing. It takes a man who could become exceptionally egocentric and say, you know what? Everybody's got their humble beginnings. So don't get too carried away with yourself. So the Torah, Kodesh Baruch Hu, has an amazing way of, on one hand, making us feel special, of inflating the ego in a healthy way, but at the same time putting in there the fail-safes, right? And putting in there the checks and balances to ensure that the ego doesn't go on a runaway trip. So says the Maharsha, that's the idea of the Seder. We're going to focus on our newfound freedom. We're going to spend the night telling ourselves and telling each other how special we are. But let's begin with the Ginus. Because the Ginus, the humble beginnings, ultimately allows us to retain our humility even through this journey of exceptional freedom and exceptional royalty. Question before? Okay. Yes. Right, 100%, correct, it's all right. I'm just saying, you know, but the Lot story, right, Enoch and Ami. So Rus herself originally hails from an act of incest. The Rus one isn't as good because she's a Gioris. So because she's a Gioris to a certain degree, she severs her ties with all of that came before. But nevertheless, you're right, I'm saying the Yehuda Peretz thing is direct. It's direct all the way through. Remember, ultimately, how does Megillas Rus end? It ends with the genealogy. It ends with the genealogy all the way from Yehuda to David HaMelech. So David HaMelech is a ben achar ben all the way from Peretz, who's the child of Yehuda and Tamar. But you're right, it comes from Rus also. We, by the way, we have no lack of these type of somewhat uncomfortable. And again, it's by design. It's the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps us humble, despite the fact that we are so exceptionally magnificent. Yes? Yes. So, Maschil B'Gnus M'Sayim B'Shevach, so that's a quote from the Gemara. We begin with the degradation and end with the praise. In Yono, the aspect of it, the concept of it, Shebiyom Simchas Libo, on a day when a person rejoices, Shebiyom Simchas Libo Sha'adam, on a day when a person is exceptionally joyous, Yisgar Tchilas Shefluso, he should remember his humble beginnings, Ugnuso, and his degrading pieces, Shelo Tazuach Da'ato Alav, in order that Da'ato literally means his intellect, but in order that his sense of self not overwhelm him, in order that he not get carried away with himself, umehai taima, and for this reason, doresh nami me'arami oved avi. We include this paragraph of arami oved avi, which is the paragraph after the first two that I quoted for you in number 3, which also makes reference to idolatry, although we're not going to get into it today. Va'al kein bo'i la'aduye u'leshabuche tfei. And therefore, we have an obligation to make this known, and as a result, we end up praising God even more. Because when you remember that we came from such humble beginnings, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us so great, this in and of itself intensifies our gratitude towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this is our first step. Well, take a look at number 10. Rav Soloveitchik also highlights this same basic idea, and the Rav writes, I call this approach number 3, but it's really part of the same approach. So the Rav writes, in the ancient world, other nations usually explain their origins as the product of a love affair between a god and a human. These nations or peoples viewed themselves as descendants of God, princes, and kings. This is not the story of Judaism. On the night of Pesach, the night of the election of Israel as a covenantal nation, we say that our election is not because we have distinguished ourselves. At first, our ancestors are idolaters, we declare, and we would have remained idolaters and pagans had not God brought us close to his service. Second paragraph, we are of humble origin. Our ancestors were simple idol worshippers. The fact that we are the people who brought to the world monotheism, a new morality, and a new set of spiritual values, is not due to our efforts or to our greatness. God came and came to us and invited us to join him. The initiative belonged to him. Our greatness came because of a special act of grace on the part of the Almighty. He could have elected any of the 70 nations, but as an act of chesed, he chose us. We did not display the characteristics that would have qualified us for the honor of being selected as God's people, as the Am HaNivchar, a covenantal community. We are undeserving and unworthy. Our Torah is very much concerned with gratitude. Therefore, on Pesach night, even before we begin to tell the story of the Exodus, we express our indebtedness to the Almighty. We are indebted not only for the miracles which happen later, but also for the very fact that he called us into his service. So the Rav really builds on this idea of humility. That it's not just saying that we become from humble beginnings, but the truth is, we are who we are because HaKadosh Baruch Hu invited us to partner with him in the creation of a destiny. So if we put all these together, the framework of Maschil Beginus U'Mesayim B'Shevach, of going ahead and beginning with the lowly aspects of our existence. And again, like we said, both like Rav and Shmuel, physical servitude, spiritual servitude, and yet we have become what we have become, and make sure that over the course of the night, as we mature into our new free selves, we don't let this new sense of freedom go unchecked and create an overinflated ego, but rather we put in there the fail-safe of humility by reminding ourselves of our humble beginnings, by reminding ourselves that we are who we are, not because of anything that we personally initiated, but because of HaKadosh Baruch who invited us to join him in the creation of a new destiny for mankind. Okay, that's our first approach. If you take a look at number 11, there's another approach. So 11 and 12, Rabbi Lau and the Malbim say something quite amazing. See, he says the following. He says like this. Okay, we'll just look at the first paragraph, 11a. So Rabbi Lau writes, "B'mishnah ne'emar." So in the Mishnah that we quoted earlier, it says, "Ki mitas v'igadata lebincha na'asis ba'oven shel maschil b'gnus u'mesayim v'shevach." That the way we fulfill the mitzvah of v'igadata lebincha, of transmitting the Exodus narrative, is through the framework of beginning with shame, maschil b'gnus u'mesayim v'shevach, and finishing off with praise. So look what Rabbi Lau writes, "I efshar lehistapek b'shevach below lesaper alaganus." You can't appreciate accomplishments unless what? You understand the challenges. You can't go ahead and praise God, or for that matter, praise ourselves for what we have done, unless you appreciate the context in which all has been accomplished. Kfi sha'anu lokhim balayla hazeh, lo rak matzah, ki'im maror. Right? Did you ever wonder about this? This solves the fundamental inherent contradiction in the Leil HaSeder, which is the Leil HaSeder is all about celebrating freedom, and yet so much of it what? Speaks about reminds us of the slavery. Right? Even the mara, it's a fundamental contradiction. You know, I'm going ahead. Oh, by the way, I skipped something. Okay, just remind me. I have to follow up on one thing with the first approach. Okay, I'll come back to it. I don't want to stop here in the middle. So, why do we eat the mara? It's a strange thing. Here we sit with our beautiful table, right? We sit like kings. In fact, one of the interesting ideas as to why we wear a kittel, which actually segues back into what we said before. Why do we wear a kittel at Leil HaSeder? Right? So the truth is actually machlokes. According to some, because the kittel is supposed to represent Big Day Mason, it's supposed to represent the burial shroud, which actually fits in very beautifully. That's the source I skipped. That's number 9, the Taz. The Taz actually brings that down. He says the reason we wear a kittel at the Leil HaSeder is to go ahead and be a burial shroud. It's part of the humility motif. That in order not to get carried away with our newfound freedom or our new status of royalty, we wear a burial shroud to remind us that remain humble. According to others, that's not the symbolism of the kittel. The symbolism of the kittel, in fact, is royalty. That what did royalty often wear? Royalty wore plain white garments. That was a symbol of royalty. In fact, we know that the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur wore plain white garments when he did the avodah, when he did the temple service, lifnai v'lifnim, in the Kodesh Kodesh, in the Holy of Holies. So here, by the way, according to that idea, Rav Soloveitchik just points out as well, many had the custom that everyone at the Seder wore white. Everyone at the Seder wore white. You see, it's clear that over time, apparently, we accepted the approach that more that the kittel is supposed to represent the burial shroud. So because of that, it sounds like the Bala Seder, the person running the Seder, wears the kittel. But if you go with the motif that the white is supposed to represent royalty, then in reality, everyone should be wearing white. And in fact, the Rav points out that there were minhagim throughout the ages that everyone at the Seder did wear white. Again, I've never heard of that being done today, but it's interesting to keep in the back of your mind. So here, this Seder creates an incredible anomaly. So here we are, decked out in white royalty. The table looks beautiful. Everything, you were drinking wine. Everything is supposed to represent freedom and royalty. And yet, we're chomping down on maror. Right? Yet we're eating these bitter herbs that are supposed to evoke literally the physical feelings of bitterness of slavery. So why? It's a contradictory experience. Says Rabbi Laz so beautifully. Because you can't appreciate freedom if you have not tasted slavery. You can't appreciate what it means to be free unless you have had a human master lord over you. He says, "Kefish anu lochim balayla azeh, lo rak matzo ki emoror, mi she'enenu makir es hamoror, lo yedo laharich es orcha shava matzo." If you've never tasted slavery, you cannot fully appreciate freedom. Umishelo mevin mahu shibud lo yodea mashmuusa shacherus. And one who does not appreciate, or at least have a frame of reference for servitude, will not come to appreciate what it means to be free. Which is, by the way, it's part of the contemporary challenge that we have with Pesach. If you ask the Jew 100 years ago what it meant to be enslaved, the Jew could tell you very easily what it meant to be enslaved. We live in a very different age. We live in a very different time, an unparalleled time for the Jewish people. We enjoy such an incredible, profound liberty and freedom like really has never been experienced before. But Nevi'im Rabbi Elahu is saying we have to create a frame of reference. We have to create a context. The Maral brings down, by the way, in the introduction to Netzach Yisrael, the Maral says, why did the Jewish people suffer so much? Age-old question. Why do we suffer so much? So the Maharal says something amazing. The Maharal says that the truth is, in life is based on opposites. What does that mean? How do you appreciate light if you've experienced darkness, right? If you've never experienced darkness, then you have no idea about the profundity of light. So the Maharal writes that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has in store for us in the Messianic era is so profound and so amazing that the way we will most appreciate it is how? By having a profound context of suffering. If we didn't suffer, says the Maharal, we would not have a frame of reference, we would not have a context for the incredible joy and jubilation that will be part of the Messianic era. By having that context, we will then appreciate that simcha in such a profound way. It's a fascinating idea. Doesn't help to alleviate the plight of the sufferer, but nevertheless, it gives us at least a theological framework. Says Rabbi Lau, that's maschil b'yinus, umesayim b'shevach. If you began the Pesach Seder by simply what? By simply extolling freedom, thanking HaKadosh Baruch for taking us out, that praise to God and that appreciation for the freedom falls short. It's only once you spend the time creating a context and a frame of reference for servitude that then when you go ahead and speak about the freedom becomes meaningful. Yes?
One hundred percent.
I will tell you that if you have not yet had a chance, not a commercial, but if you have not yet had a chance to read his biography, his autobiography of Out of the Depths, exceptionally profound. And when you read the rest of his works, you'll then out of the depths. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau. I'm sorry? Out of the depths. That there's also, if you want to read it, I mean, he originally wrote it in the Hebrew. You can read it in the Hebrew, but you have to have a very good, it's like modern Hebrew, so it's very, very difficult. But the book is absolutely astounding, and there's no question. When you read then the rest of his Torah, it resonates much more when you realize, just so you know, Rabbi Lau was the youngest survivor of Buchenwald. There were no children survivors of Buchenwald. They weren't the children were exterminated immediately upon coming to the concentration camp. He was the youngest survivor. He was 8 years old when he was liberated. He spent 4 years in the concentration camp. So he writes in his book how after the war he went to live with his aunt and uncle in Kiryat Mutzkin. I can't remember his uncle was a rav there. I can't remember the name. And he said his aunt, this was his father's sister, wanted to introduce him to the neighborhood children, that he should make friends. He should play. So They went outside, and they started playing ball. And they threw him the ball, and he had no idea what to do with it. Because at 8 years old, he had never seen a ball. Because he spent his childhood in the concentration camp. I'm just saying, and yet, amazingly enough, he has become one of the most influential figures, you know, within the modern day Jewish people. It's quite amazing. So it's very true. When you see his Torah about context, it does resonate. So if you look at number 12, the Malbim expresses the same theme. So the Malbim writes, he says, "Umitchila mikan maschel etzem asipur." The Ra'a Bala Godal HaChel HaSipra Me'az Mireshis B'Terem Mitznitzna Emunas Yisrael the Avram Avinu Shekir Esboro. Let's skip a little bit. He says, if you skip to paragraph B, he says, Kirak Az Yo'olel HaSipor Pu'uloso La'asos Roshem Belev La'hakir Eis Asher Hetiv Hashem Imanu. So the Malbim says the same idea. It's only when you recognize where we came from that you could come to appreciate ultimately what Pesach really means. If you don't understand where we started, then you can't appreciate the incredible miracles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has done for us, and in reality, the incredible things that we have done for ourselves. So this is our second approach. Maschil beginus umesayim b'shevach. We begin with the negative things, with the degradation, with the shame. Again, this is all adopting both Rav and Shmuel's approach. That the shame referred to over here is the shame of physical enslavement, theological enslavement, spiritual enslavement, being idolaters. We begin with it. Why? It creates a context. Because we can only appreciate that which God did for us, that which we did for ourselves, if we appreciate where we originated from. Which then leads us to number 13, a third approach. The Beis Halevi says something simple but exceptionally beautiful. The Beis Halevi writes in number 13, Mitchila of the avodah zarah hayu avosenu. Originally, our forefathers were idolaters. Now, there's a lot of dispute as to who this is actually talking about. Who is it referring to? Now, many understand that it's actually referring to our forefathers in Egypt. That in Egypt they worshipped idolatry. But the Beis Halevi writes, Mikan raya l'mashikasav Rambam. This seems to be a proof to what the Rambam writes. Degam Avram avinu avad mitchila avodah zarah ayin sham. That Avram Avinu must have worshipped idolatry. You know that there is a fundamental dispute between the Rambam and the Ravid. What's the fundamental dispute? When did Avram Avinu recognize God? When did Avram Avinu recognize God? So the Ravid writes, he was 3 years old. Now, obviously, he goes without saying 3 years old, it must be a radically different conception as to what we, I mean, it's this, the Gemara says that Rivka Imenu was 3 years old when she got married. So obviously three must be something very different than what we know, which would make sense. I mean, lifespans are much longer, but it can't mean three as we know it today. The Ravid, Rabbi Avraham Ben David. Rabbi Avraham Ben David, he's a commentary on the Rambam. So the Ravid writes 3. The Rambam writes 40. Rambam writes that Avram found God at the age of 40. Right? Age of 40. Now, of course, the fundamental dispute between the Rambam and the Ravid is what? What's the fundamental dispute? Don't say how old he was. Right? What's the fundamental dispute? Well, no. Before we get to this, what's the fun? Was Avram Avinu an idolater? Was Avram Avinu an idolater? If Avram Avinu found God at the age of 3, he was never an idolater. According to the Rambam, he was an idolater for the first 4 decades of his life. He was an idolater. He was a card-carrying idolater. So Beis Halevi writes. Beis Halevi writes that this section of the Haggadah seems to be a proof to the Rambam that indeed Avram Avinu was an idolater. That Avram Avinu found God at the age of 40 after having served probably multiplicity of idols all of those years. Why? He says, "De'im kein, de'im akavon al terach, mahu lashon avoseinu." Because avoseinu refers to someone with whom we have a relationship. If avoseinu was referring to terach, then ultimately, again, we don't consider Terach, the father of Avraham Avinu, as part of our lineage. Yes, technically speaking, our family tree goes to him, but he's not considered our forefathers. The first person who would be considered one of our forefathers, even though it's in the plural, is Avraham Avinu. Therefore, says the Beis Halevi, this Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avosenu is a reference to Avraham Avinu, the idolater. He goes on them, Me'apasuk Shemevi Terach Avi Avram. Okay, so he goes on, he discusses. So according to Beis Halevi, Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu is reference to Avram Avinu. If that's the case, the power of Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shavach is what? That it teaches us that no one is beyond salvation. Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shavach. That even, see, according to the first 2 approaches, Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shavach, beginning with the lowly, shameful parts and ending off with the praise, with the good parts, is how we experience the Leil HaSeder. How we experience the Leil HaSeder? Either it's aid to keep us humble, despite the fact that we are celebrating our autonomy and our personal prowess, or number 2, it's to give us context. We can only appreciate salvation if we understand where we came from. According to this 3rd approach, it's much more personal. That what is the Seder about? Like we said before, the Seder is about feeling free. What does feeling free mean on the most basic level? What is freedom on the most basic level? The ability to become someone special. That's freedom. It's not to do whatever you want, because again, Hashem Baruch Hu doesn't let us do whatever we want. So freedom means the ability to become someone magnificent. So what holds us back from becoming magnificent people? You're all magnificent people. What holds other people back from becoming magnificent people? What holds people back? Baruch Hashem, no one knows. Right? People feel they're damaged. People fear they're damaged. So I'm damaged goods. I mean, who am I? Who am I? Look at the way I've lived my life. Look at the failures I've had. Look at the things I haven't done. Look at all of this stuff. Who am I? So what does the Haggadah do? Maschil Beginus. We begin with some very negative stuff. Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. You know who started out as one of the major idolaters of his region? Avraham Avinu. And yet, Mesayim B'Shevach. But yet, even those who begin with such negative beginnings could end the story off in a beautiful way. Or in other words, Maschil Beginus U'Mesayim B'Shevach doesn't just teach us how to appreciate the Pesach story, the Pesach experience. It teaches us how to undergo the cathartic process of becoming free. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows that we sit down to the Seder, we're going to try to become free. In the back of our mind, we're thinking about all the baggage that we each lug with us throughout life, and all the ways in which we feel damaged, and all the ways in which we feel less than perfect, and all of the reasons why we think we can't become something magnificent. And so how does that go to start? I'm going to give you an example of someone who started out on a really bad path. Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah Avoseinu, Maschil Beginus. But ultimately, we're the testament to Avraham Avinu's incredible accomplishments. See, even if life starts out with Ginus, even if it starts out with difficulty, with negativity, how you finish the life story is up to you. Even if it's Maschil Beginus, each of us have the power to be Mesayim B'Shevach. We have the ability to end off the story in a beautiful and magnificent fashion. Yes? Correct. Everything, the truth is, I've come to realize that everything that we learn together is always rooted in the framework of Gadlus HaAdam. Because if you hold Shiflus HaAdam, correct, it doesn't go anywhere. All right, one last approach, and then we'll conclude for today. One last approach. And again, as I often mentioned to you, these are not mutually exclusive, meaning all these approaches co-work beautifully in concert with each other. We've seen now two approaches that help us understand the dynamic of the Pesach Seder, one approach which is very personal in nature. Now we come to our last one for today. So the last one, interestingly enough, take a look at number 15. This is a little bit of a long piece, but I think it's worth just looking at together quickly. So Lord Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in his Haggadah Shel Pesach, has a number of beautiful essays on the Haggadah. And in here, he quotes the following idea. Look at number 15a. If you want to understand the people, listen to the way it tells its stories. In the literature of humanity, there are many kinds of story. There are those, we know them from childhood, that end with the words, and they all lived happily ever after. We call them fairy stories, fantasies, myths. In the artificial reality they conjure up, the evil dragon is slain, the wicked witch defeated, the curse lifted, the conflict resolved. B. Beyond myth, there is a second literary genre which we owe to the Greeks, namely tragedy. Tragedy tells the story of human beings with their aspirations and ambitions in a world governed by impersonal forces. To be human is to wish, to plan, to dream. But our dreams are destined to crash against the rocks of a reality fundamentally indifferent to our existence. They are hubris and are always punished by nemesis. Letter C. A tragic universe is a place where bad things happen for no particular reason. There is no ultimate justice and no expectation of it. Where we learn to accept with stoic courage the random cruelties of existence. Letter D. Judaism has no such stories, because it does not believe in myth. In the Jewish narrative, the battle against evil is never complete. The Messianic age has not yet come. Until then, we live in a universe in which, though there is liberation from Egypt after Pharaoh comes Amalek, and after Amalek, other tyrants, injustice must be forth in every generation. The legacy of the Exodus is not a world in which they all lived happily ever after. There is no closure, no sense of ending. Instead, there is something more real and at the same time more radical. Shabbos, a world of rest in which is temporary but no less utopian, where one day in 7 weeks we experience pure unmediated freedom and gain the strength to continue the journey to take up the struggle. Letter E. There can be no tragedy in Judaism. That is not because there are no disasters, crises, catastrophes. Manifestly, there are. Jewish history, as often not, has been written in tears. Nor is it because of Jewish story there is always a happy ending. That, to repeat, is the structure of myth, not Judaism. But there is always hope, grounded hope, justified not by optimism, innocence, or a Whiggish theory that sees history as a constant progress, but by the terms of the covenant between heaven and earth. Judaism is the principled rejection of tragedy in the name of hope. Letter F, we're almost finished. The Pesach story, begin with shame, end with praise, is the archetype of the Jewish reading of history. Its insistence on rescuing a thread of meaning from catastrophe, its refusal at times heroic to be demoralized by defeat, to give in to the siren call of despair, it is the rejection of myth and tragedy, optimism and pessimism alike. The Jewish narrative does not ask us to believe in a world which there are simple happy endings, nor does it allow us to take refuge in the cynical belief that every aspiration ends in failure. Letter paragraph G. There is nothing peaceful about hope. Far simpler to believe nothing, expect nothing, reconcile oneself to the meaninglessness of a universe endlessly revolving in silence around the void, and therefore accept the inevitability of fate. Far harder to strive for injustice against oppression, freedom against tyranny, just skip down a little bit, yet to be a Jew is to choose what Levinas calls difficult liberty over easy necessity. Israel says the Torah is the people whose name means one who struggles with God, with man who prevails. Far from being simple or naive, hope demands, creates, and is the expression of indomitable moral courage. Or in other words, what Rabbi Sacks is so beautifully saying is the following. That maschil beginus means what? That we begin by accepting the difficulties in life. we accept by reaffirming the fact that we do not subscribe to the concept of tragedy. We do not subscribe to the concept that bad things just happen randomly for no reason. Maschil beginus, we begin by acknowledging and accepting the difficulties that are part and parcel of the fabric of existence. Umesayim b'shavach. You know, it's interesting. Although Rabbi Sachs doesn't say it explicitly, I think this is what he means. You know, it doesn't say maschil beginus umesayim. How would you end that phrase? Maschil beginus umesayim b'simcha. Right? It doesn't say we begin with difficulty and end with happiness, because that's and everyone lived happily ever after. And you know what? We don't have those endings either. Very often the ending is not b'simcha. But you know what the ending is? Umesayim b'shavach. We end with praise. Praising who? Praising God, because we recognize in retrospect that so many of the difficulties that He has subjected us to have been character building, have been nation building, have contributed to an unbreakable sense of resilience. Misayim b'shavach, we end with praise of ourselves, that we recognize that we as individuals have been able to weather so many different storms, and because of our personal resilience, we've been able to become magnificent individuals. So according to Rabbi Sachs, this is the paradigm for the Seder. Maschil beginus, we begin. Judaism doesn't try to make everyone live happily ever after. Judaism doesn't try to deny the existence or the presence of suffering. We begin by acknowledging it, by accepting it, and in reality, by embracing it. And we also don't go ahead and say, oh, and don't worry, everything always works out fine. Everyone will always live happily ever after. That's not the way life works. Umesayim b'shevach. There's a difference between saying everything works out beautifully and wonderfully, and everything works out. We believe in the latter, we don't always believe in the earlier. Not everything works out beautifully. Sometimes things work out tragically. Sometimes things work out in a very sad fashion. But we believe that everything always works out in a constructive way, according to the divine plan, in a way that will ultimately benefit us as individuals and as a people. So according to Rabbi Sachs, what really comes out so beautifully is that Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shevach is not just a framework for the Leil HaSeder, it becomes a framework for life. We begin by acknowledging again the difficulties, embracing the difficulties, and we understand that life doesn't always end happily ever after, but we believe in praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu because we see the meaning in the difficulties we've endured, and we begin in praising ourselves for being so resilient to weather all the difficulties and vicissitudes of life. So I'll take questions in one moment. Just to bring this all together, here's what we have. In trying to understand the nature of the framework of Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shevach, right? Why do we follow this order as the Leil HaSeder of beginning with the negativity, beginning with the down points, and ending off with praise? First of all, whether we accept both Rav and Shmuel, we begin by discussing the fact that we were physical slaves, we begin discussing the fact that we were spiritual or theologically compromised because we hail from idolatry. Why is this framework necessary? So approach number one is it keeps us humble. It keeps us humble. It ensures that over the course of a night where we're trying to build ourselves up by highlighting our dominant feature as free men, as royalty, that royalty does not get out of whack, it does not go too far, it does not lead to an unhealthy, inflated ego. We keep ourselves humble by reminding ourselves of our humble beginnings. Approach number two, you need the genus in order to appreciate the shevach. You can't appreciate the miraculous redemption if you don't have a frame of reference for the difficulties that preceded it. Approach number three, the Beis Halevi. It inspires us. Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shevach is not just a statement about the Leil HaSeder, but it's a personal statement of individual maturation. We hail from idolatry, Avraham Avinu. But no matter how damaged a person may be, no matter how compromised a person may be, no matter how much genus there may be as part of a person's individual identity, Messiah B'Shevach. No one is beyond salvation, no one is beyond redemption. And finally, we come to the approach of Rabbi Sachs, that Maschil Beginus Umesayim B'Shevach ultimately teaches us not just about the Pesach Seder, but it really is an insight into the nature of the Judaic dynamic. Maschil Beginus, we accept the fact that life is difficult, not tragic, because tragic means that things are random. Tragedy means that there are things just beyond your control that are just whimsical. That's not what we believe. Maschil Beginus, we accept the fact that there are difficulties, that there are tragedies in life, but the tragedies are not tragic, at least in the Greek sense. As Rabbi Sacks wanted to say, umisayim b'shavach. And we acknowledge the fact that although life, the story often doesn't end with everyone lives happily ever after, we recognize that everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu subjects us to ultimately is for our benefit. We grow as individuals. We recognize that when we are able to weather the storm, we emerge stronger and more bolstered to lead meaningful lives. Yes? It's true. The truth is, the beauty of Tehillim is no matter what you learn, it's always going to be in Tehillim, but it's very true. It's very true. Yes? Correct. There will be, well, the truth is yes and no, because there also is a fundamental dispute as to what's going to happen, and I'm sorry, what's going to happen in the Messianic era, meaning how supernatural is the Messianic era going to be? Right? Does it mean that literally everything is just supernatural existence, or no? Meaning, Malchus Mashiach will be here, right? Everybody will recognize God. There'll be an autonomous Malchus Yisrael, but the world will continue as it is. That there is a school of thought like that. So, I don't know, but I will tell you that there will be certainly a dynamic more resembling happily ever after in the Messianic era than there is now. Yes? Oh, that's right. Beautiful. Ours is to have it. I take even a step further. Every age is our golden age. That's the beauty of the Jewish people. We don't wait for golden ages. We create golden ages. All right, I think this is our last class of our Pesach. So I wish everybody a Chag Kosher V'Sameach, a wonderful Yontif. And the Mirat Hashem will continue after Pesach, still in Kapitel Tes Zayin. I think that might take us through the semester.